On April 24th, 2024, I was woken up at 5 in the morning. 50 armed FBI agents were raiding my house. That's the first time I've had any contact with federal law enforcement. Never had any indication that there was any problem.
So both of these charges were conspiracy to commit. Neither were an explicit, we believe that you have laundered money or that you are actively operating an unlicensed money transmitter.
That's why we created Samurai, to build code and build tools that allowed people to claim that privacy that they had lost. We thought what we were doing was completely within the letter of the law. They clearly disagreed.
Do you feel like there was some sort of a conspiracy against you in all of this? Because to me, that feels like such an egregious violation.
It certainly shook me. Like, these people are playing by a completely different rule book. They say they're about truth. They say they're about justice and law, but they're not. They're about winning their case no matter what, no matter what the truth is.
Hey everyone, Michael here with the Bitcoin Way podcast. Thank you for tuning in. Today on the show, I have Keone Rodriguez. This is a special episode. Please stick around to the end. This is one of the Samurai devs. He is headed to federal prison for 5 years, and it is our opportunity to step up, to help him, to serve and support he and his wife. It's a crazy story. It's more injustice than I could ever describe on my own. He says it best. I think you're going to enjoy and hopefully be heartbroken by this episode. Hey everyone, like I said in the intro, I have Keone here with me. Keone, welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Yeah, I really appreciate you taking time. I know time is of the essence for you, and something you are probably valuing immensely at the moment. And so I want to dive in here. I'm hopeful that this is an episode that's going to wake a lot of people up, get people moving, mobilized toward what I believe to be a very, very important cause. Let's start at sort of the beginning. Talk about Samurai, what it is that you developed, what the intent was, and how it operated. I think that would be a good place to begin.
Sure. Yeah. So Bill, who is my co-founder, and I met in 2012 while we were working at a Bitcoin wallet company called Blockchain, still around today. And back then, it was the largest non-custodial Bitcoin wallet and one of the only Bitcoin wallets that many people use back then because it was available on the web. And, we met there and we both had very similar thoughts and ideas around Bitcoin and what it was most useful for, which in our view is a replacement for cash, cold hard cash in the digital world. And we worked there until around 2016. But in 2015, Bill and I started to get a little discouraged with the trajectory of the space. A lot of emphasis was being put on scaling Bitcoin, and we didn't feel like enough emphasis was being put on the privacy aspect of Bitcoin. As you and your listeners no doubt know, Bitcoin is a pseudonymous system and a public and transparent system. Anyone can go onto a blockchain explorer and view transactions past and in the future, and they will be etched into the blockchain for eternity. By 2016, however, that pseudonymous system was sort of under attack, with all the new people joining in using services like Coinbase and other exchanges. They were unknowingly to them tying their identity through KYC, which is know your customer information. They were tying that to their Bitcoin and they didn't realize it. And that becomes a problem because the pseudonymous system, which fosters a cash-like environment, suddenly became an identified and permissioned system, right? You wouldn't be able to spend your Bitcoin without the person you bought it from, Coinbase or any other exchange, knowing what you were doing with it. This is a real problem for Bitcoin. And we didn't feel like it was being addressed at the protocol level. And instead of forking off and working on an altcoin or leaving the space entirely, we said, well, we love Bitcoin. We want to work on it. Let's just build the software that we want to see. And we both know how to build wallets. We've been working on a wallet since 2012. The wallet is the most fundamental gateway that the user has to interact with the Bitcoin network. Let's build a private wallet. Let's build a wallet that focuses on user privacy and, most importantly, transactional privacy on the blockchain. We can't do it at the protocol level, but we can do it at the application level. So that was really the genesis of Samurai Wallet, was to build a wallet that Bill and I wanted to use, right? We had been getting paid in Bitcoin since 2012. It's now 2015. We need to spend Bitcoin to live, to pay rent, to buy groceries, to do all the things that a normal person uses fiat for. We had the need to do it with Bitcoin, and we wanted some level of basic financial privacy. We weren't getting that anywhere else. So we said, let's build Samurai to get it. And that's what we did.
So when someone would interact with Samurai Wallet, what at a sort of at a semi-technical level, I guess, what was happening to that would be different from other wallets on the market? Or obviously, if you're just going, you know, operating on an exchange, a KYC exchange or something, what was fundamentally different about it and how did that work?
So I think what the first thing to make exceptionally clear is that Samurai and every piece of code and technology we produced was always non-custodial, meaning the user always retained control, total control of their private keys. So this was an essential aspect of the entire ecosystem that Samurai built, was that we never wanted to take custody or control of anyone's funds. So we always put the user first in that regard. Second to that, because as I explained, the Bitcoin blockchain is public and open, anyone can look at any transaction. The really only way to gain privacy from a system like that is to pollute the publicly viewable transaction graph. And you pollute it by making it confusing, by adding complexity to what otherwise is deterministic, right? Meaning there's no other option than A connects to B. If we add A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, then there's confusion. No one who's observing that transaction externally really knows who A paid or who received from H. So the general idea of all the transactions and all the functionality that we built was non-custodial and add confusion to the public transaction graph. So that's essentially what we're doing. So we're basically using math to add confusion to a public network.
Yeah. So in my view, there are so many open source tools out there that do something sort of adjacent to this, like, you know, VPNs, for example. I mean, maybe not a perfect analogy, but there seems to be something about financial privacy in particular at the moment that is, it's catching the attention of regulators. It's obviously caught the attention of the Southern District of New York. What do you think the distinction here is that, you know, I can run a VPN on my browser and no one's going to jail. What's the difference with what you all were doing in your view?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's been a steady erosion of financial privacy in this country, in the United States, but also around the world since the 70s. That's really when we start seeing legislators coming up with the Bank Secrecy Act and the first kind of appearances of suspicious activity reports and anti-money laundering. And it really ramps up after 9/11, where now banks and institutions are required to do all of this reporting, all this KYC, AML. So it's really not that old of a system, right? It really came into its own in 2001. And since 2001, the expectation of any financial privacy has been rapidly eroded. And governments and people in positions of power like it. That is good to them. So any attempt by a software developer or a business owner or whoever that the government and the state and people in power perceive to be chipping away at that, chipping away at their control and their visibility into the financial system, they take very seriously and they will come after with a very heavy hand. But that isn't the de facto state of things. Prior to around 2001, we as Americans and many people around the world enjoyed quite a high level of transactional privacy. And even as you go further back, we've had total levels of financial privacy, right? When it was just cash and coins, no one knew where those cash and coins came from that you were using, and no one cared what they, you know, if it was the proceeds of crime, for example, no one cared because money was fungible. Coins and specie were cash was fungible. And that was a fundamental property of money. That's the default and de facto situation. It's only recently in modern times that governments have demanded that our entire financial lives be open to them, that they know every transaction that we're making. And, you know, I disagree with that proposition fundamentally. And that's why that's why I was attracted to Bitcoin. I saw that as Bitcoin as being a counter to that. And two, that's why we created Samurai, to build code and build tools that allowed people to claim that privacy that they had lost back. And we thought what we were doing was completely within the letter of the law. And they clearly disagreed.
So I don't want to distract, but I do have a quick question. Would it have been your preference in the earlier days of Bitcoin, like, you know, when you started developing this, that a change had been made at the protocol level to enhance privacy? Or would that have come with trade-offs that maybe you wouldn't have been happy with? Like, was the application layer the right place for this to happen?
No, I think the protocol is the right place for this to happen. Would it have come with trade-offs? Almost certainly. You know, life is a game of trade-offs. I think it would have been easier to deal with the trade-offs the earlier it was done in Bitcoin's history, but to a point, right? Like, people forget how innovative Bitcoin was, because now we're inundated with crypto and tokens and meme coins. And yeah, your grandmother probably knows about crypto, right? So it's entered the common, you know, parlance. But in 2009, it was revolutionary and no one understood it. Even, you know, nerds and people into this sort of stuff didn't really get it. And had Satoshi designed Bitcoin to be an anonymous system like Monero is, where you can't really see what's going on and you can't really see amounts, or like Liquid is, where you can't see the amounts that are going on, I think it would have been even tougher to catch on. People would certainly not trust it and would have a really hard time getting their heads around it. So I think, you know, it's a fine line. But I think by 2012, had the protocol developers on Bitcoin decided that it was the right time to start adding serious privacy improvements, Gregory Maxwell introduced confidential transactions, for example, that could be done in a way that could be verified against supply. I think we would have been able to stomach that as a small nascent community and get our heads around it, and would have been, and Bitcoiners would have been better served for it. But I think there was a lot of concern by core developers and other stakeholders that adding privacy, like strong privacy, would be antagonistic to regulators who would then try to shut Bitcoin down. And they felt that that would be a risk to their investment in Bitcoin. So they decided to sacrifice privacy, say, no, we're not going to touch that. It is what it is, in hopes for, you know, a greater return on investment by way of keeping regulators, you know, at bay. So we don't know what would have happened, but we have the hand that we've been dealt. We knew by 2015 that protocol level was not going to happen. And it hasn't. Like, we've been vindicated in that. So the only option was either go to Monero or something else, or build on the application layer of Bitcoin, you know, and that's what we decided we wanted to be.
Yeah, that makes sense. So talk a little bit about the judicial process that you have been through. When did it start? What were you charged with? And then we'll get into like the specifics of, you know, how you fought this for the last while.
Sure. Yeah. So on April 24th, 2024, I was woken up at 5 a.m. 50 armed FBI agents were raiding my house. There was armored vehicles all down my street, drones, guns, and, you know, the whole nine yards. It was a full scale raid. And that's the first time I've had any contact with federal law enforcement. I never had a phone call before. I never had any indication that there was any problem with Samurai Wallet until this point when they raided my home. You know, they had guns trained on me. They had guns trained on my wife. They took me into custody, took my wife into custody, detained her, and we separated us. Eventually, thank God, she was let go and she was allowed to leave the area. But they spent hours going through my house, you know, getting anything electronic, anything written down, any notes, and took that over to their field office, I guess, and took me to the FBI field office in Pittsburgh, where I live, processed me, fingerprints, biometrics, DNA. And from there, then took me to the jail where I was waiting to be seen by the judge to arraign me. That's where I say guilty or not guilty. And to hopefully, at that time, I didn't know, but hopefully get bail so I could come back home and begin looking for a lawyer and dealing with, you know, just the whole day. So I spent about 7 hours, I think, at the jail. And at a certain point, I was allowed to meet a court-appointed attorney who was going to help me through the arraignment process. And she's the one who first told me what the charges were. This is where I first learned what the charges are. So this is now, like I said, 6 hours after the raid. And I learned that I've been charged, not in Pittsburgh, but I've been charged in the Southern District of New York, a place I haven't been to for well over a decade. I've never done business there. I've been charged in the Southern District of New York for two crimes, conspiracy to commit money laundering and conspiracy to operate a money service business without a license. And my initial reaction to hearing my court-appointed attorney say this was to laugh and say, are you sure that they must be confused? Right? Because in this space, since 2013, we've had the regulator who's been really clear about money transmission and illicit finance. And they've been, the regulator's called FinCEN, the Financial Crime Enforcement Network. And in 2013, this is early stuff, 2013, they basically say that you're not a money transmitter unless you take custody of the funds, unless you take custody of the money, which is pretty common sense regulation, right? Because otherwise, how could you transmit something if you never have it? And then they reiterated that in 2019, said you need to have custody to be a money transmitter. And they explicitly state in 2019 that if you're anonymizing service and you don't take custody, then you are not a money transmitter. It's black and white. So that's why in my head, I'm thinking, well, these, you know, they must be confused. They must not understand the way Samurai is built and works. They must think it's a mixer like the old school Bitcoin fog and chip mixers where a user would send them their Bitcoin and get sent back other Bitcoin. That's where my head was at then, because it would seem so obvious to me what the regulation said and how we were fully in line with them. Unfortunately, I was still naive, thinking that they made a mistake. They didn't. They knew exactly what they were doing, and they just didn't care. They said it pretty much straight up that what FinCEN says doesn't matter, even though FinCEN's the one who, you know, determines if you're a money transmitter or not. They said what FinCEN says doesn't matter. What we say matters. And we say that because you built this software, you are in fact a money transmitter, and therefore you are liable for money laundering because you're a money transmitter and you didn't do the things that money transmitters need to do, like collect KYC and AML.
So both of these charges were conspiracy to commit. Neither were an explicit, we believe that you have laundered money or that you are actively operating an unlicensed money transmitter. Is that accurate?
Absolutely. And it's an important distinction.
Yeah. And right. So the unlicensed money transmission to me seems just like a flat bogus charge. The conspiracy to commit money laundering feels open-ended enough that perhaps they could try drumming up enough evidence to suggest that that was an intent that you had, that there was a conspiracy, right? So I don't want to jump too far ahead. So what did you ended up pleading? Ultimately, you pled guilty to one of the charges.
Right.
And that was the
money transmission.
Mm-hmm. So what happened with the money laundering charge?
No, they dropped it.
Okay.
In return for the plea. So you make an interesting point, though. One, that it's a conspiracy charge, right? Because if it was actual money laundering, they would have to find someone who I laundered money for. Right. And that person doesn't exist. Right. Their theory is just by creating this code, this software, there's no other legitimate reason for it other than laundering money. That's the intent. That's a conspiracy. But an individual or a software developer who's not a financial institution doesn't have the same requirements that a financial institution has, obviously. So in order for their money laundering theory to stick, they actually needed the unlicensed money transmission as well. So the unlicensed money transmission was important because by saying that we're an unlicensed money transmitter, they were able to say they are a financial institution. And because they're a financial institution and they did not enable KYC and AML, that was part of the object of the conspiracy to commit money laundering. So there was a collection that worked together, but it was all from a flawed premise because we weren't a financial institution. And FinCEN didn't think we were a financial institution. And they've been saying, you know, since 2013, that a software provider explicitly isn't a financial institution. So it was all from a flawed premise to begin with.
Has any new guidance from FinCEN come out in the midst of these legal proceedings? You're operating under the same rules that you've described from 2013, from 2019, the more recent. Yeah. And then I've heard you tell the story somewhere in the midst of all of this. You found out that they had gone to FinCEN to basically ask, like, hey, are these guys, you know, should they be a license, you know, licensed as a money transmitter? And FinCEN said no. Is that correct? Right. And when did that happen?
So we found out about that a year after prosecution began. So in criminal trials in the United States, the government has a constitutional obligation to turn over all evidence that they have to the criminal defendant, me in this case. Whether that evidence is good or bad, everything has to go over. It's called the Brady Rule. The government didn't hand over everything, we later found out, because we explicitly asked them a year after everything began. I don't even know why we asked it, but my lawyer asked, he said, hey, have you had any conversations with FinCEN about this? And the government had to respond truthfully and said, well, yes, we have. Here's an email chain that we had with FinCEN. And I was like, well, you didn't hand this over to us until we explicitly asked, which is a Brady violation. Because we looked at it, and this is what we would call exculpatory evidence, meaning evidence that is very good for the defendant. Government asked FinCEN, as you described, hey, are Samurai Wallet money transmitters? And FinCEN responds in black and white, no, they don't take custody, so they're not considered a money transmitter under our guidance. Couldn't be any clearer. The government then hid that information for us for over a year and indicted us anyway 6 months later for unlicensed money transmission and money laundering, a conspiracy to commit money laundering.
What do you remember what the date of that email chain was? Like when they were going back and forth with FinCEN?
January, I think.
I'm sorry?
December of 2023 or January of 2024, something along those lines.
So they raided your home, began the process, this whole process, they had already received notice from FinCEN that...
Correct.
Okay. Man, this is wild. So
indictment was even brought. So they hadn't even got an indictment. So an indictment is, if your listeners don't know, the government writes up their allegations against you to say, these are the things that these people have done to commit these certain crimes. And it's they're only allegations. And they bring that to what's called a grand jury. And it's the government, the grand jury, and the judge. You're not there. You don't even know what's happening. Your lawyer's not there. They don't know what's happening. It's a secret proceeding. And they brought that information to the grand jury, the indictment to the grand jury. But you don't know what they've said at the grand jury. But I can say, I highly doubt they brought the grand jury the information from FinCEN saying that we weren't a money transmitter. And that's another violation. They're supposed to bring all the evidence to the grand jury.
Is a violation like that? That sounds to me like one of those things that might be a case for dismissal.
Yes.
Would that be common? Or
I wouldn't say it's common, but it's certainly something the judge can do. Right. So you'll see it a lot. I mean, this happens all the time in criminal proceedings in this country, Brady violations constantly. And usually the first one, the judge will, you know, say, hey, don't do that again. But if it keeps happening, the judge can and has and will dismiss the whole thing as kind of a punishment to the government. That did not happen here. And we can get into that aspect of the story in a bit. But needless to say that a Brady violation is a serious constitutional violation. So you better believe that we wrote a motion to the court, you know, saying as much, saying, judge, we've just discovered this information. It's been withheld from us for over a year. It's a Brady violation, and we want to know more about it. We want to know why it was held from us, who decided it to be held from us, and what other conversations they've had with FinCEN, either by email or by phone, because it may be exculpatory information.
So tell me a little bit more about that. What was do you feel like there was some sort of a conspiracy against you in all of this? Because to me, that feels like such an egregious violation. The regulatory agency said this does not apply to them, and they proceeded anyway. To me, that feels, if anything is evidence for dismissal, it would be that in my mind.
Correct. Yes, I did feel that way eventually. I didn't feel that way immediately, right? So I started on this side of the spectrum where it was, they must be mistaken. They must be confused. And then as the case goes on and little things keep happening, and I start to go, well, they're not really playing fair, right? And they're definitely stretching the truth. And actually, they're outright lying. And then to have this bombshell of a revelation, it certainly shook me. Like, these people are playing by a completely different rule book, right? Like, they say they're about truth. They say they're about justice and law, but they're not. They're about winning their case no matter what the truth is, right? They are going to win. They're going to distort every fact and any truth to get what they want. So by this point, I think I've realized that. But it wasn't until the next thing that cemented everything for me.
Yeah, I can't. I imagine you're, as this is actually unfolding in real time, you're under the impression as you go through it that this is the way that these legal proceedings work, and you imagine that there might be mistakes made, but you know those get corrected as you go. Okay, so I want to get to your opinion in a moment as to whether or not this was just more or less a witch hunt. They want to send a signal to others, you know, who are developing in sort of the privacy space. But so how did this all wrap up? Like, what was the plea deal? What did you agree to? What did you plead guilty to? And what were your options? Like, what options were actually laid out for you?
Yeah. So to get to there, I have to explain why my mindset changed from we're absolutely going to fight this all the way to we better take a deal, because it wasn't about the evidence.
Right.
It wasn't about guilt.
Clearly not.
So we wrote that motion that I was just describing about the Brady violation. And that was one of several motions that we had put forward to the court. And a motion is just basically, here's what we want you to do, judge, and we need you to rule on it, right? We need you to either accept it or deny it. That was an important one, and one that kind of was hard to argue against. The government was pretty embarrassed by this. The second one was equally as important, if not more important. And this was called the motion to dismiss. And a motion to dismiss, you have to, at this point, accept everything that the government has said about you in the indictment. You have to accept that as truth. You're not going to argue any of those facts, right? You're only going to argue the law. And that even if everything the government says about you is true, you should still dismiss all charges because the law says this, that, and the other thing. That's what a motion to dismiss is. And we put together a very compelling motion to dismiss. We had Supreme Court precedent. We had appellate court precedent. We had stuff from 1940 where a sugar distributor got charged with a conspiracy charge because he sold sugar to a bootlegger who created illicit alcohol because it was during Prohibition where alcohol is illegal. And the appeals court and then the Supreme Court affirmed it, said, you can't be charged with conspiracy because of just mere knowledge. Just knowledge that a crime can occur or is occurring isn't enough. You have to be part of the crime. That's how a conspiracy charge should work. Supreme Court said it. We had a precedent from the 90s where a company that creates grow lights for gardening and tomatoes and stuff like that was charged with conspiracy because they sold the grow light to a marijuana manufacturer, someone who was growing illegal marijuana. And this person even advertised the grow lights in High Times magazine, which is a magazine all about marijuana. And the guy even had jokes. He joked with the person he was selling to, saying, I don't even want to know what you're doing with these grow lights. Government had such a case. And jury convicted this guy. And the appeal court overturned it, said, no, again, just knowledge of the crime isn't enough to be a conspirator in that crime. You have to be actually part of it. So we had way more cases, but those are the two that I like to highlight because there's so many parallels to our case. So we brought this up in a very well-done motion, and we were ready to argue our motions, that one and the Brady violation. Then suddenly, out of nowhere, our judge changes. We had one judge at the beginning, and usually that judge sees you through all the way to the end. But out of nowhere, 2 or 3 days before we're supposed to argue our motions, the judge changes. And now we have a very different judge who has a very different reputation, has a strong reputation as a pro-prosecutor judge. Herself was a former head of the criminal division at the Southern District of New York, and has a reputation also for being a very harsh sentencer who will give you the max. That's what she's known for. So, you know, not great, but still don't really know what to expect because we've never seen her. So we go up when we're supposed to, we appear, and we're ready to argue these very important pre-trial motions. And before we even get a chance to say a single word, she says, I've read your motions and I'm denying them. No argument, no one getting up to plead our case or give, you know, our version of why she should consider it, just denied. And how can you deny the Brady violation? It's in black and white. It's written down from the government to FinCEN, and they never sent it to us. It's shocking. But not only did she deny these motions, she didn't write any opinion, and she didn't say any opinion. Normally, when a judge grants or denies anything, they explain themselves. They explain why they're granting it, or why they're denying it. That's just common in courts. She didn't do any of that. She just said denied and moved on. At that point, that's where I was telling you about my spectrum of how I thought about this case. At that point, I reached the end. And I knew that there was no shot of fair trial here. They were going to throw the book at me, and they were going to make it impossible to win this case if the judge isn't even going to listen to arguments. or comment on arguments that are 100% valid, we don't stand a shot at this. And the downside is 25 years of incarceration. And she will give every single year of that 25 years. So at that point, we started to seriously consider our options in terms of taking a deal if one was offered, because there's no point to fighting if you're fighting with your hands tied behind your back and your legs shackled together. It's not a fair fight.
Right. So I think it was after hearing a couple of these pieces put together that it went from just a, like an injustice to like, this is really a witch hunt. Yeah. And to what extent do you think, because the thing I'd forgotten was that the judge changed. Do you think that was like a politically strategic move of some kind, or I suppose it probably happens. Yeah. Do you have
it's rare. It does happen, but it is rare. You know, it doesn't happen often.
Does it? Do you raise your eyebrows at that, or is it all these other things? Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely. I don't know. All I can do is speculate, because that entire process is not transparent at all. What goes on in the courtroom, behind the bench, in the judge's chambers, we don't know. And we're basically on honor system, where the government's not supposed to talk to the judge without us there, right? We don't know if they're abiding by that. It's all honor system. And I think it's been clear that these prosecutors have no honor. If they had honor, they would have abided by the Brady rules, and they would have turned over all their evidence, and they wouldn't have lied or mistruthed things. And, you know, so a lot of this process is the basic trust that we have in the prosecutor's office. And I think most people who have never gone against the government have that basic trust. And me now, who has experienced our Department of Justice, has none of that trust. So who knows what went on behind the scenes? Did a clerk at the other judge let slip to the prosecutor that the judge was considering dismissal? And then maybe we should better get a different judge unless you want these guys to go. Who knows? And that's total speculation, because we have no insight into the process. But it definitely was a witch hunt. The whole case was completely novel. They had never brought a case like this against anyone else before. A non-custodial tool. Now they're saying that everyone had thought since 2013 and before could not be classified as a money transmitter, suddenly can in 2024, right? We had been operating openly for 10 years. Nothing about our operations had changed. It's just their interpretation changes in 2024, and they come after us in a very big way. So it absolutely was a witch hunt.
So explain then the deal that you ended up taking, what you're facing now. I mean, we're recording this on December 8th. What the next couple of weeks looks like for you?
Yeah. So, yeah, like I said, at that point, once I saw that display, I knew that there was not a chance of a fair trial here. People don't realize that the judge controls a huge amount of a criminal trial. The jury doesn't hear all the evidence. People think you'll tell your side of the story, the jury will hear everything, and they'll make their decision. That's not how it works. The judge decides the evidence the jury hears. The jury wasn't going to get to hear about FinFen. The jury wasn't going to get to hear that we had a lawyer who said what we were doing was legal. The jury's not going to get to hear a lot of the stuff that I've said over the last 10 years, right, that go directly to my intent. So once you realize this, you realize how stacked the deck is against a criminal defendant when a deal was offered. And we have a judge who's just not even considering our motions. When a deal was offered, both Bill and I decided to take it. You know, after a lot of, you know, back and forth and thinking about it and arithmetic in your head, you realize that the downside of 25 years, which you will get every year of, is too great. It's too great a risk for me and my wife, but especially for Bill and his wife. Bill's 67 years old. He would die in prison. That's unacceptable. So they offered us a deal that they would drop the money laundering charge, which has the maximum sentence of 20 years. And we would plead to money conspiracy for money transmission, which has a 5-year maximum penalty. They also told us that if we didn't take the deal and we went to trial, they were going, and we lost, they were going to put in an order for a forfeiture payment to the government of $237 million, which is something that's completely astronomical. We don't have that kind of money. And they know that. That's part of why they said it. But they claimed that $237 million was sent through Samurai Wallet that was illicit. So we would be held responsible for every cent of that. And once we got out in 25 years, we would owe the government $273 million plus interest. And until we paid that off, we would be under essentially incarceration. So it's basically a life sentence. You know, it's basically a life sentence.
So not to step us back too far, but my understanding is perhaps some of the tools used to identify like the amounts that you described, $237 million, kind of bogus, made up, a lot of guesswork, best, you know, sort of best judgment of those operating the tools. I don't even know how you would know that with,
yeah,
by virtue of how your tool operates, you know?
Yeah, it's absolutely a pseudoscience. Right. There's chain analysis, chain surveillance is all about heuristics. So heuristics is a fancy scientific word for a guess. And it's about how probable something is. Their numbers were $2 billion worth of Bitcoin went through Samurai Wallet. Of that $2 billion, $287 million was illicit. You know, the proceeds of specified criminal activities. So by their own numbers, we're talking 10% of the total, right? Which is way less than cash, you know, and way less than probably like JP Morgan. But besides that, this is their own numbers. And we didn't get a chance at this point to double check these numbers, right? And we know from other criminal cases the government has brought in recent years, primarily against Roman Sterlingov, where they accused him of running Bitcoin fog, we know that you're actually unable to cross-examine Chainalysis when you want to try to figure out their methodology for how they came up with these numbers, because the government comes up and says, "Oh, you can't ask that question. It's a matter of national security," and by those magic words, you're cut off from your constitutional right to examine your accusers. And we saw that happen with Roman Sterlingov. And one of the things I think that the government really didn't like about us is Samurai Wallet, through use of our tools, and primarily a tool called OXT, which was an open chain analysis platform for free, we aided the defense of Roman Sterlingov. We got in touch with his lawyers and said, "Hey, we're going to use our platform to provide a counter narrative to what the government is saying about your client. They're going to say that this and that and the other thing were criminal proceeds. We're going to show you how you can, you know, counter that through the same techniques that they're using to provide doubt." And we did that. We worked for free and we tried to help his criminal case as best as we could. So I'm sure the government knew about that and wasn't too pleased. But I digress. You're absolutely right. So the heuristics that they use, you can't really verify them. And we didn't get a chance to verify them. But even if we believe what they're saying, the percentage of quote unquote illicit activity was pretty minor.
Yeah. This is, it's just such a gross injustice. It seems like every step of the, because I think back to the beginning of your story, 50 federal agents raiding your house, under what pretense, you know, like a knock at the door probably would have been enough for you to
absolutely
say, "Hey, you know, I have federal agents at my door." It's like a display of force that was just completely unnecessary all the way through the changing of the judges, everything that happened with FinCEN. the opaque method by which they collected this information about how fun, how many, how much the illicit activity might have been operated through your service, to the extent that it even happened to begin with. It's all speculative in my mind.
Yeah.
Okay, man. Well, hopefully, I think you've laid out a very good case for why people need to be paying close attention to this. I truly hope that you've gained some sympathy from the folks who listen to this podcast, and that they're going to step in and do what we all can to help. This question I'm about to ask you, my hope and prayer would be that you spend far less time than 5 years in prison. However, if that were to be the case, 5 years from now you get out, what do you want to have seen done in this space for privacy? What would success look like as a community that we could be pushing for?
I think what I would like to see and hope to see is that Bitcoin community, the Bitcoin community, isn't chilled by these actions. The privacy community in particular isn't scared, that they recognize that there are way more of us than there are of them, that we have a fundamental right to privacy, and it takes courageous people to build those tools, and they need to learn from what came before them. So they look at Samurai Wallet, who operated openly and notoriously because we believed we were in compliance with the law, and they'll now know that even if you're in compliance with the law, that doesn't matter. They'll still come down on us. So we're going to be more anon. We're going to, you know, make better OPSEC decisions, and we're going to build in the shadows because that's what the government has forced us to do, but they're still building. And, you know, I think it would be a defeat if, and this is what the government wants, they want people to see the 50 armed FBI agents. They want people to see, you know, the 25 years, the $6 million fine, the $250,000 restitution. They want people to see all that and go, oh, I better not deal with privacy. That's too dangerous. That's not, you know, I'm not going to do that. But we need brave people to step up and do that, because that's the only way that Bitcoin really is useful for anything. If there's not privacy, it's not useful. It's just a toy.
I think that's a great call to action. Okay, I'm going to ask you my last question, then I want you to give a handoff for where people can support you, find you. So what is an unpopular opinion you have? You get some bonus points if you offend Bitcoiners with this.
I've been offending Bitcoiners for over a decade.
You're good.
Unpopular opinion. I mean, I guess it just, we can just tie it in to everything I've been saying, that Bitcoin is not number go up technology. Right, it's not a thing that's guaranteed to always go up in value because it's the perfect, you know, form of money or digital gold or whatever it is. For Bitcoin to be useful, to be have actual value, it needs to be what Satoshi designed it as, which is peer-to-peer digital cash. That doesn't mean Bitcoin Cash or Bcash, you know, scaling 1,000 megabyte blocks. That has nothing to do with it. But it needs to have the same properties that physical cold hard cash that you have in your wallet has. And that means privacy, that means security, and that means self-custody. And if it doesn't have those things, like I just said, it's nothing more than a toy, a collectible, a stamp. If we want it to be anything real, it's about uncensorable, permissionless technology. And I've said this throughout my entire career, both as me, Keone, but also as the Samurai Wallet handle on Twitter. And these opinions were used against me. These opinions of saying this were used as evidence of my criminal intent. And so I can't think of anything more controversial than criminal thoughts. Bitcoin is for everyone. Not, you know, it can be for anyone, criminals included. They are going to use technology. They are going to use Bitcoin. They are going to use Signal. They are going to use Tor. They're going to use tools. Nothing we can, and they definitely use cash, right? So we're not worried about that. we're worried about building functional private tools that can be used by the majority of people in totally legitimate reasons, and for totally legitimate reasons, not criminal in the slightest. Privacy doesn't equal crime, right? But we're not going to stop building this because criminals might be able to use something, even though that's what I'm going to prison for. Don't give up on that.
I love it, man. The Moon Boys and the Cowards will not like that opinion, but I think that's an important one to express. Alrighty, so tell people where they can find you. I don't know, as you head in this down this new path, is there going to be a way that we're going to be able to continue to follow along with you the way I think Ross Ulbricht, we did? And then where can we go support you financially in terms of raising awareness for, you know, a potential pardon, things like that?
Yeah, so I think the best place right now, you can follow me on Twitter, at Keone, K-E-O-N-N-E. But if you go to billandkeone.org, again, that's billandkeone.org, that has a link to a petition that's really, I know it sounds so lame to go sign a petition, but it really does help. I was in a space last night, and Ross Ulbricht from the Silk Road actually showed up in the space and spent a 10 minutes talking with me. And someone asked him, you know, what really worked for your campaign to get a pardon? And he said the petition was so useful in getting the people to notice you. Now, of course, he had hundreds of thousands by this point, but it was still very useful. So please go to billandkeone.org, sign the petition. There's also a link to donate there. Right now, while Bill and I are both out of custody, the only option for donation is using GiveSendGo, because we're under court order not to send or receive crypto payments. So we don't want to run foul of that order. So the only way to support us is using fiat with a card. Once both of us report to prison, that website will be updated, and Bitcoin and Lightning probably will be available for donation at that point. But yeah, you can support us there for that. And I hope to be able to communicate with people through my wife, who will run my Twitter account and has her own Twitter account as well. So I don't know how often I'll be able to speak to the community through her, but I will try to.
Okay. Terrific, man. Well, we're going to be keeping tabs on you and doing everything we can to support you. I'll make sure we link to that in the description, and I'll share in the outro, remind people to go follow you, pay attention to what's going on. We need to stand up. It's time. This is bullshit. And anything we can do along the way, we're going to be at it and making some noise. So thank you so much for being here with your precious time, my friend.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Best wishes to you. We'll be praying for you.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Cheers. And that's a wrap. Again, I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Keone. Let's do everything we can to support him. Go sign the petition, send some fiat in there, help him out, make some noise. We need to stand up, because we need privacy tools. We need the type of people like him who have been building the space for so long to bring us value in our ability to transact permissionlessly without fear of censorship. We need the Keones of the world. So let's help and support him. If you need help taking your Bitcoin into proper 100% self-custody, do me a huge favor. Go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast. You can schedule a free 30-minute consult with a member of our team. We'd love to talk with you about how we help you secure your Bitcoin sovereignly. We've got online privacy tools. We've got a privacy phone setup we can walk you through, a Plan B residency option as well. Again, that's thebitcoinway.com/podcast. And of course, do me a huge favor, especially for this episode. Go like, subscribe, comment, share this with someone who you think might be interested and willing to pitch in. Anything to feed the algorithm. We need to get this message out now more than ever. It's incredibly important to be a part of this movement. And until next time, stay safe, stay sovereign, and remember, the yield on Bitcoin is freedom.